there's always this moment where like the concert's finishing and like end of the last movement or whatever, or like even when that applause is coming, like it ends, and then it's just like this great like cathartic moment where it's like all this work I've done and all this like time moving, it doesn't just translate into like money in my pocket, and it doesn't just translate into like a good business deal for somebody else. It like makes people happy.
Welcome to episode 118 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, what's up, folks? What's up, folks? Here's a little update. A couple episodes ago, I read a review that was left about the podcast, and the review was basically, you have cool guests on the show, but shut the F up, right? That's on the previous episode, I read the review as it was written, and that's what it was. And my response to it was, hit me up directly, right? Email me. It felt personal, so let's hit me up personally. I did not receive an email after that episode, but what I did receive was an Instagram message on my personal account. That it was from, I'm not going to say the name or even the handle, but it was from somebody that had no picture, no followers, was following nobody, and had no posts, right? It was like a completely barren account. And they sent me a message that was nice. They said, cool, I listened to your podcast for the first time. You know, it's the way you, you know, interact with the guests. It's very much like jazz. It's just a conversation. You know, they went on to say some very kind things, and I appreciate that. But it did feel a little weird that the person, it still kind of felt like a catfish thing, right? I don't know. I thank the person for the kind words, and I also asked them if they were indeed B-flat jazz bass, the one that left the, that told me to shut the F up on podcast, on Apple Podcasts review. Don't know, never heard back from that. So, but that's just where that landed. That's what happened there. Is the mystery continues to grow, but it's not as negative as it was previously. What else is some news? All right, this is happening. So I have this PJ, right? I'm gonna nerd out about gear just for a second. I got this PJ, Defender, you know. P bass, jazz bass, it's got a jazz bass neck. I was interested in new pickups for it. I bought the bass, one, to have a four string to teach on. Two, it's kind of a like a little fun hobby bass where I can just mod it and just check out different stuff that I'm curious about and use that as the bass to do it with. So I've been kind of going down the rabbit hole of looking up different pickups and different PJ sets. And then a friend of mine suggested, like, dude, just do a review, like, document the process of it and, you know, review each pickup. I'm like, that's fascinating. So there's a couple companies I'm interested to check out their PJ sets, only because, you know, I want to, and I want to hear it back to back. And so I'm going to completely standardize the shootout, right? Same bass, the same rig, everything. Everything is the same. So, and even have kind of different players come in. I'll play it, obviously, for myself, and I can hear how it reacts to me playing. But for the shootout, to document the process that I'll eventually post, I'm going to get some other players in here that have a different touch than I do. So maybe, you know, someone with a harder, who digs in really deep, will get a different sound out of the bass than I am. And that, you know, that will speak to how the pickup reacts to digging in like that. So that's the thing. I'm putting together this shootout. The companies that are at the top of my list to reach out to for PJ sets are Delano, Aguilar, Nordstrand, obviously Fender. Howard Ouyeit built the custom pickup for my 5-string fretless. I want to hit him up. I would love to check out his pickups in this. The reason I'm talking about this now is because if any listeners have a pickup company in mind that you think should be part of this shootout, hit me up. That's what I'm asking for. Is, you know, I would hope that the listeners of the podcast would be involved. And if you have a pickup company, or if you've been interested to check out a pickup company, you know, and you'd be interested in having that pickup company be part of this, let me know. I'll see what I can do. I don't have a lot of pull in the bass pickup world. You know, I'll make them part of the process, and there's no guarantee that they'll even want to be. And I'm probably not going to personally buy every set of pickups. So if they want to send me something to be part of the shootout, that would be killing. We'll see what they do. We'll see what they do. I don't know. But that's happening. So if you have a company or one specific PJ set you're interested in, let me know. Let me know. I mean, I've also considered, like, what if it's just not a set, right? Just getting like a very specific P and then getting a specific J and building kind of a custom PJ set. That was on my mind for a little while. I was looking at different P pickups and different J pickups. I don't know. From all the reviews I've read so far, Aguilar's PJ set is pretty killing. Right, lemurmusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass can be found at lemurmusic.com. Stop by the website, check out their inventory, bows, basses, accessories, pickups, sheet music. It's all there. lemurmusic.com. Lemur Music. Well, I'm on the topic. Lemur Music is a sponsor of an event happening in Southern California on Sunday, March 17th at 3 p.m. The event is Dr. Matt Hare will be performing a concert on the world-famous Carr Koussevitzky bass. Man, every time I say Koussevitzky, it's like I have to, like, did I say that right? I don't know if I said that right. I remember going through it a few times, like practicing it on the air here. Koussevitzky. Yes, it's the world famous Carr Koussevitzky bass. This year is the 150th anniversary of Koussevitzky's birth, and so the bass is making the rounds. Right, the bass is on tour, and the Southern California stop will be here from March 17th to, I believe, April. It's about a month. I think April 13th, maybe even a little longer. But on March 17th, Dr. Matt Hare will be performing a program with some Koussevitzky pieces and some other pieces. You can find more information about this at thebassjetacademy.org/events. Dr. Matt Hare will also be on the podcast in a few weeks talking not only about his events. It's not just a business card and a flyer he's waving. Like, we had a really good talk. Right, on the episode is Russell Thompson. Russell Thompson is a double bassist. I'm sure you could tell by the picture there. He's also the principal bass player of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. I had met Russell when he reached out to me and was interested to get involved with the Bass Shed Academy, which was very exciting for me that he somehow learned of it and, you know, reached out and was interested to be involved. That was all very exciting to me. And so him and I got in touch and we had some conversations about that. And then I really wanted him to be a guest on the podcast, and the timing worked out and he was able to. Look out for some more educational resources and materials from Russell. We're in the planning stages of putting some things together, and that's all very exciting, and I'm really looking forward to releasing those. What I loved about the talk with Russell in this podcast is the conversation was so universal and kind of inclusive. Everything can be applied to not only classical double bass playing, or, you know, even more specific, playing principal in an orchestra. It was a broad conversation that can be applied to a lot of different genres or even other musicians and instrumentalists. It was a fantastic interview, and here's my talk with the principal bassist of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, Mr. Russell Thompson.
How you doing?
Doing all right. How you doing?
Good, good. You're with me in my hotel room in Amarillo this week.
Amarillo.
I'm playing an away game, so.
Who are you playing with?
Amarillo Symphony. I'm in the section there. We're playing Bartok Concerto for Orchestra and Bach Harpsichord Concerto and Don Giovanni Mozart Overture.
Okay.
It's going to be a great concert. I love playing out here. Great conductor, like just a great vibe.
Sweet. Yeah. How long you been playing with them?
This will be 3 years. I won the job when I was living in Denton, And then I was able to keep it. And luckily, there's a travel stipend that'll just barely cover a plane ticket. So I can fly out when I'm in Little Rock, too.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Yeah, yeah. I got stuck in all that snow yesterday. I was supposed to leave Monday, but... yeah.
Oh, wait. There's a bunch of snow back there?
There was a... Well, that big storm came down, and my flight out of Arkansas got canceled and pushed back, and then my flight to DFW in Dallas got canceled, and so I had to stay there a night, and then stayed with family that night in Dallas, and then went back to the airport the next day, but it was like a 36-hour delay.
Oh, man. Oh, man. That sounds awful. That sounds awful.
Yeah, well... Luckily, I'm here now. I only missed one rehearsal, so it should be fine.
Okay. Okay. When's the concert?
Friday and Saturday.
Okay. Okay. Cool. You mentioned Denton. Let's get a little backstory for the listeners. I know your backstory, but for the listeners of the podcast, let's get a little backstory. Originally, where are you from?
Oh, originally, I'm from a little town on the east side of Cleveland called Chagrin Falls. Kind of, okay. It's a lot like Stars Hollow from Gilmore Girls, but in Ohio.
Okay.
You know?
I've never seen Gilmore Girls, small town. But I understand the vibe. Good. Yeah. Okay.
It's got a gazebo. It's pretty. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. My parents were both musicians, so I grew up like having that all the time. They made me play something, and I was always tall. I always had big hands. So like I started playing bass in fourth grade.
Oh, wow.
Kind of kept it going. And then when I was in middle school, I think my mom, who's a freelance bassoon player in Cleveland, she set me up with Tracy Rowell as my teacher, who's just like unbelievable. She's one of the best bass players I've ever worked with. And I was just so like stupid fortunate to be able to work with her at that age. I really had no business being there, you know?
Okay.
And then, originally went to the University of Mary Washington. I got a scholarship and I was playing lacrosse out there actually.
Okay.
But I was double majoring in music there as well. My teacher was, he had been the bass player in the Air Force Airman of Note for like 35 years. It was this guy, wow. Master Sergeant Paul Henry. Chief Master Sergeant Paul Henry. Yeah, he'd been in the band just forever. He was I think he was a Eugene Levinson student back in the day.
Okay.
And then, I was just like, what's this guy doing out here? And we started talking excerpts and, you know, and then after my freshman year, I went to a music festival. I went to the National Music Festival, the very first year that it was established. And I remember we did Mahler 1. And John Chiego was my, like, the bass mentor there that year. He played in Memphis, and he taught at University of Memphis for a long time. Really great guy. And we were playing Mahler 1, and I was sitting next to him. I got to sit second on that. And we got to the end, and I just, like, you know, I don't know if you've ever, like, heard played that piece, but, like, the last 5 minutes are just this, like, ecstatic, just, like, outpouring of happiness, and it's like D major is just so triumphant. Yeah. And like we finish and he looks over at me and he was like, "You're really good at this. Like, why don't you do this all the time?"
Well,
he's
great
like,
question.
"Man, you clearly like love this." And I'm like, "Man, like, because I want to have money. Like, yeah. I want to be like happy in my life. You know, like I wanna not do the whole freelance thing." And he's just like, "Man, if you love something, like you gotta go find it." And like I kind of blew him off at the time, and I made it a couple months, and then it was like October, November of my sophomore year, and I was just thinking to myself, I'm like, I'm getting up every morning at 8 or 7:30 before my classes to like go in and practice in the mornings. Like, why am I doing this? I'm at this little school. Not that it wasn't a great opportunity to be there, but like that wasn't the vibe of the music department.
Right.
And I was like, I'm doing this all the time. And like, what is it that I really want to do? And so it took a long time for that to click in where it's like, it wasn't like I found something I like and I just fell into it. It was like kind of realizing like I have to do something.
Now I had watching your parents, your mother was a freelance bassoon player. Your father played what and was he freelance?
Yeah, my father played horn. He was in the West Point Field Band in the Vietnam years, and then he became an engineer later in life. I grew up most of the time with my mom, the bassoon player, and then my stepfather, Rich, was a jazz doubler, saxophonist, flute, clarinet. He played in the Cleveland Jazz Orchestra for years, and he taught at the University of Akron. He taught saxophone there.
Okay.
Played a lot of Broadway musicals in sure. Cleveland, pretty much everything that came through for like 25 years.
Okay, okay. So did that, being around professional musicians at a young age, did that taint your view of like, yeah, that's cool, but I really don't want to do it? So when you know.
Yes, like totally. Yeah. totally. Like, just like it was, everything was always so tight. Like it was always right. So like, especially freelancing in Cleveland at that time, kind of after the 90s, early 2000s, the city really kind of cratered because all the steel works and all the other industrial stuff moved out around that time. So mm-hmm. like a lot of the work that had been in the city, it used to have the Cleveland Orchestra, but also used to have the opera. There was a ballet. There were two or three other orchestras that were working. A lot of it either folded or just reduced. And like having to watch all that happen and watch like how paycheck to paycheck freelancing really is and like the time commitment of it. Yeah, it really, like, it was something where I was like, yeah, I like playing the bass, but like, I don't want to do this. I was trying to get like an English degree and maybe do like pre-law, something like that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I was like, not thinking about that at all. And then it took a long time to be like, well, this is what I love. Like, why would I get a degree? Why would I like spend my life working at something that doesn't bring me that kind of joy? Like walking away from that was too much, I guess, was what it was. Right. It's like, I couldn't do anything else, which is a nice privilege to have.
So now, I mean, I know you have the job as principal of the Arkansas Symphony, but you also freelance mm-hmm. on the side. Thinking about those years and like your, I don't want to use the word contempt, but you weren't really interested to jump into the freelance world, but now it's a part of your profession. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you feel about it now? And like, what would you tell yourself back then?
That's a great question. Honestly, it's not far off from what I imagined. like it's not untrue. Like all the stuff that was there, like I knew it was gonna be that.
Yeah.
And like, yeah,
I mean, you got a great representation of it though. Like, you were fortunate uh-huh. to grow up in a house where you saw what it takes to continue to practice, to stay working at your craft, to grind out the freelance lifestyle. Like, you got a really, that's kind of a, you know, lack of a better word, privilege to be able to witness mm-hmm. what it's actually like, instead of just getting into it because you love it and then trying to figure yeah. it out, you know, while it's happening.
Mm-hmm. The thing that kills me so much, especially about freelancing and especially in a lot of these sort of smaller per service orchestras, and especially on top of that, in a really big market like Dallas, Fort Worth, was just like how replaceable you are.
Yep.
And how like little, like nobody's looking out for you. Like
no.
there were a lot of orchestras in that area. I don't know what your thing is on this, but like I played for an orchestra, the Las Colinas Symphony. I played there all through the pandemic. I think I was there 4 years. And then
they were still doing concerts during the pandemic.
Oh yeah. Oh, in Texas, like nothing changed. I don't think I lost a single gig when I was in Texas during the pandemic. I don't think I lost one gig. Like, our paychecks went down because like they had problems fitting the audience in. They're like, oh, we'll do sure. every other seat or something. But like, no, I was fortunate because I sat in the front half of a lot of those sections, so I didn't get reduced out where they needed
right.
to like make more space on stage. So okay. I was lucky for that, but like I didn't lose that much work, which was really shocking. And I'm like, I'm so sad to hear about all these guys out in states that actually care about people that live there.
Yeah, I mean, like, back in you know, like, over here
everything was canceled. Yeah,
over here in LA everybody's, you know, working on some side hustle, trying to teach online
yeah.
or driving for Uber or oh, whatever, yeah. you know, it was dark. It was dark in LA for musicians.
Yeah.
Okay. So now,
I mean, like in terms of being, sorry, like in, I mean, in terms of
yeah,
being like, replaceable like that,
sure.
there was that orchestra I was playing with, Las Colinas Symphony. They're based out of DFW. They gig in Garland and Arlington and in Irving, three sort of suburbs out in DFW. And I had a death in the family last February. My sister passed away.
Okay,
so like I had a concert, I had a concert coming back, and her funeral was Easter weekend that March. And I was flying back. She was an expat. So she passed away and she was living in the Netherlands at the time. So mm-hmm. we were there for the funeral and I was coming back. And the way that they did their cycles was they would have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday rehearsals. And that Sunday rehearsal was like a 2-hour string sectional.
Okay.
I'm flying back in on Sunday. Right. And so I send the personnel manager an email saying like, I'm so sorry. Like I lost my sister in February. Like I'm flying back in. Can you please let me out of this little two-hour sectional on that first Sunday? Like I'm happy to come. I'll be there like guns loaded Monday. I play for you guys 4 years. Like, you know that like I'm not going to come and phone it in. And he emails me back and says like, oh no, we're going to go ahead and just take you off that cycle. That whole cycle, so you won't get paid for that whole week. And then on top of that, like we're going to go and you're under your service minimum now. So we're going to go ahead and not renew your contract for next year.
Oh my gosh.
Like that's the level. Like
who is this person? Like, who is this person? Replaceable. Was that,
that went up to the maestro. I have emails saying that was the conductor who is a,
did the conductor have it out for you or something? Like that almost seems kind of personal. You know what I mean? Like,
not to my
zero understanding.
That's a
zero
recurring thing.
Mm-hmm. Really?
That's been a, oh yeah, 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 yeah. That if you find there's other players I could get you in touch with, like it happens all the time, and particularly with that orchestra. Like they were on the they've had a lot of problems negotiating with the players, like getting people paid fairly. It's a real nightmare. But like, yeah, they can just decide like, no, we'll get whoever else. So it's like not even stuff that's in your control a lot of times.
Right. Sure. Sure.
I'm sorry. I was interrupting though. What were you going to say?
Oh, that's, I actually forgot. that's both like fascinating and like pisses me off. You know, like,
oh God, I think about that once a week where I'm like, I just want to just go back and cut that guy's tires.
Yeah.
Like, oh man. Like
get revenge. So I actually kind of wanted to circle back now after what would the advice be to young you, you know, if you had to go back and about the freelance, what you thought it was is accurate. How would you, speak to the younger version of yourself, letting them know like, but it's worth it. Everything you're thinking is accurate, you know, young Russell, mm-hmm. but the payoff is, what?
Music's one of those things where like you get out of it, not always true, but like you get out what you put in. And so like if you're deciding like this is the process like I want to have in my life and like this is how I want to move forward, like it's a question of like, are you going to be that cream that sort of rises to the top in those different types of like those different levels of auditions? It's like you got applying to college, you've got applying to grad school, you've got summer festivals, you've got little orchestras, like regional stuff, and then you got all these big stuff, like all the Ixam orchestras. Like it's like different, it's like prize fighting, you know, it's like different weight classes almost.
Right. Working your way up the ladder.
And I mean there was And so it's like you're making your way up the ladder and you're improving that process. And like there's that end of it. But there's also like while you're doing that, you get all these great fulfilling moments. Like I think like a lot of the concerts I play, not all of them for sure, but a lot of them, like there's always this moment where like the concert's finishing and like end of the last movement or whatever, or like even when that applause is coming, like it ends and then it's just like this great like cathartic moment where it's like all this work I've done and all this like time moving, it doesn't just translate into like money in my pocket, and it doesn't just translate into like a good business deal for somebody else. It like makes people happy.
Right. Right.
And like, that's huge to me. Like I like to think a lot about playing, and I think a lot of the people who are going to the concerts are going and working 40, 50, 60 hours a week at jobs that maybe aren't fulfilling, that they don't even like, or they don't even want to be, or they just want to go somewhere else. They just want something else. And like, I'm so fortunate to have found something that's like so meaningful for me, but also like can give someone else that feeling of like fulfillment and of happiness. Like I like to think a lot about that.
Yeah. I mean, I genuinely think that, you know, our role as musicians and artists in society is we're offering something. It's all a service. You know, art is a service to give back, because they need that, because they didn't, maybe they had they had the thing that we all have, you know, but they never pursued it or were never encouraged to pursue it or something. But they need this thing, and we need them to show up. It's a mutual experience, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that's a big payoff for me too.
And I'm sure you have this as well in your life, where it's like, I'm not the most talented player that I know that I went to school with. And it's like, so many of these people were in school that you're like, damn, I'm never going to play like that. Or like, I wish I could do what that guy does. And now it's like, oh, he's doing something else. Like, the life just really wears out a lot of people. And that's so true. It's like the best ability is availability, you know, like if you're going to stay in the game and like make yourself there, like that goes a huge way as well. I don't know. That's a bit of a tangent, but
I agree. Yeah, I mean, like so much of it is like the only way to the top in anything is to keep climbing. That's the only way you get there. Is, you know, that thing.
Perseverance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I definitely knew it was going to be a grind like that. And it was exactly what I thought it was going to be.
At what point did your career that set in? Like, yeah, okay. I've watched this happen, you know, with my parents and your stepfather. Like, okay, mm-hmm. I've watched this happen. Now I'm here. Did you feel equipped?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely like some of the nuts and bolts stuff that I need to do better about, just like managing the money part of it. And like when I was a kid, when I was just starting out, like managing the schedules, being in a bunch of different orchestras and having to be like, I'm sorry, I can't do this. Or like, for God's sake, like double booking yourself. Like we've all been there, you know, stuff like that. But like you get through that and you learn to like set it up and, you know, be where you're supposed to be. But like, it's a really chaotic life too. Like I play in 5 different orchestras. And so I'll be in Little Rock sometime and then I fly to Amarillo or I'll drive to Fayetteville or I'll drive to Texarkana or wherever. And that's like just your home this week. And like, that's a lot to adjust to, like not having that stable home. That was tough.
Have you been able to kind of, work out a version of a work-life balance that is working for you, or are you just kind of a slave to the gig?
Both. You know, like I mean, like there's, you gotta have your priorities. Like there's one thing gonna always sort of come first, and like it's gotta be playing, or else it's gonna be something else, and you'll lose that drive, or you'll lose that thing. I don't know. I kind of feel that way, where it's like, if this isn't your dedication, like something I took away from my time with Max Dimoff when I was at CIM, is like, he very much approaches the bass like a craftsman, or like even like being a manual worker. Like it's all about like building up those muscles and like getting those calluses in, and like being there, and like you could just play it. They'll put it in front of you. You just got it. And like his whole ethos was just like, I'm going to be showing up on the job and like be in the best shape I can to be there. And like, that's huge. And like, that's a lot to maintain.
Right. It's of course. Yeah. I mean, it's like everything else, you know, to use that analogy of physical, whatever, you know, you have to deal with your diet. You have to deal with consistency, you know, all that being said, then you got to worry about your sleep cycle and making sure that's consistent to fund the whole thing. And so, I mean, it's a complete lifestyle. It's a complete lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if you don't find time for yourself and for the things that you love, like you just won't make it. So like, there's a lot of stuff. I'm really happy living in Little Rock. Actually, it's a beautiful state. There's so much hiking. It's easy to get outside.
Had you been there before you
fishing a little bit? I had been subbing a little. I subbed there for about a year and then I won the job.
Okay. So, the thing that fascinates me about classical players, and like, you get this job and you have tenure in it, correct?
I am in the tenure process currently, but yes.
Okay. What are you on, like, not a probation, but like a review period for a couple years before you're officially?
Yeah.
How long is that review process?
Two seasons.
Two seasons? Okay.
Yeah. And because I had actually won a section job for a year, and then that restarts when I went principal. So it's two years from September. Oh yeah.
Okay. Okay. Oh, so you're newly principal then?
Yes. Yeah. I won the job in May.
Okay. Okay. When does the season start then? September, and ends when?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to say April or May.
Okay. Okay.
So it's mostly pegged into the school year. It's about 100 services a year.
Wow. Where I was going with this is, like, you get the job and it's a steady employment as a musician, but you have to relocate, you know, right? Mm-hmm. for all the audio listeners, there was a steady-ish.
It could be steadier, but yes.
Right. But then you have to relocate. Like, did you ever think, like, don't really want to live here? Or would you only audition for orchestras where you were cool with the city? Because it would suck to be like, yeah, the gig's cool, but I hate this place.
But I hate it here.
I mean, I'm not saying you hate Arkansas by any means, but that would be like that'd be kind of a double-edged sword.
No, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's the golden handcuffs thing where it's like, yeah, I'm stuck here. Yeah, like,
right.
Totally.
Right, so were you only auditioning for...
For stuff where I wanted to be? Not particularly, no. It was more just like, what do I think is going to be kind of next for me? Or what do I think I can take down? Like, what's going to be attainable?
Okay.
Or, like, what's a reach that's not going to be like an oh my God reach? Like... I'm probably not going to win the next Boston Symphony spot. Like, I'm probably not going to win. Like, I'm just, like, not quite punching at that weight class yet.
Okay.
If I was being completely honest for myself. But, like, I'm getting to the point where I'm starting to be advancing and I'm starting to take down, like, jobs that can offer some stability. And, like, it's part of that trajectory, for sure.
And having more time. That's a big one. Trusting the process is always a big one. Having more time as principal, like, that's going to... You're going to get a skill set together, mm-hmm. and just, like, you know, logging in hours. If you're a pilot or something, you're just logging in hours. And most of the time, that's the only way to get to the next thing is just log in the hours.
It's true. And I love sitting in the back of sections and just, mm-hmm. like, being that guy who's in the back and who's, like, going to come in every time and who's going to, like, push that sound from the back and just be, okay. like... The kind of person who your principal player is never going to look over and be like, hey, we got to fix that.
Yeah,
it might just be like, oh, little, you know, like little adjustments. But like, I love that. Like, I love being in the section. Winning a principal job was a bit of like an adjustment for me because I don't like being that guy who has to turn around and be like, hey, that was out of tune. Or like, I don't want to pull someone aside and be like, hey, we got to fix this. Or having to coordinate with everyone else. Like, for me personally, a lot of the times I don't love doing that. I think a lot of musicians don't, because most musicians are really sensitive.
Yeah, absolutely. So is it mainly just the disciplinarian aspects of principal that you're kind of like, this isn't, you know, it doesn't align with your personality and all that stuff?
A little bit. I'm starting to get, who knows, maybe not.
Yeah.
It feels like it's starting to get a little more comfortable and like finding a good group of guys a good group of players that like you can come in and feel like there's a lot of cohesion there. Like
sure.
we have a lot of people on our sub list and that are in our section that I really am happy to play with. And I'm like, oh, thank God you're here. Like, let's go. And like, that's a great feeling to be able to be like, hey, these guys want to come and they want to play with my band and they want to come and play with me. Like, that's really nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, like, these are also my friends. And like, I went to school with a lot of these people and a lot of them are, and a couple of people in the section are older than me. And so it's hard to be like, you know, you don't want to look at someone who's been in the game for like a long time and be like, hey, this isn't quite right. You know, like that's
right.
A lot.
how do you go about setting the tone for the section to keep them they're all strong players, and so it's not like you have to coach them on how to play the bass, but to keep that level up so where they come in prepared so you don't have to be the disciplinarian. Like, if you How do you go about just keeping that, you know, keep them making sure that they've done their homework and they're dialed in themselves so that you don't have to single anybody out and be like, you know, hey.
If you figure that out, let me know.
No, like, I haven't figured it out. Taking notes here right now. I'm waiting for your answer.
It's like, I don't know. You got to find a way to talk to kind of everybody, but it's like, actually, like, this is the one thing we got to fix. And so, like, it's a lot about trying to lead a little bit more by example, like always be early, absolutely. Like try to be the guy who shows up with it going. And like, if it starts with a good connection between your principal player and your conductor, or the principal player and the other like front desk string players, and you can be plugged in, that makes it easier for that sort of like stuff to filter down the chain back to the section, and like for them to have clear sight lines up to you and to the conductor, and like having it be clarity. And like,
yeah,
there was a saying, I need to get better about this, like saying stuff the first time. Ed Barker would always say, you know, when you're in rehearsal, don't forgive anything. And when you're in performances, you forgive everything.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? It's like nobody's going to go into a performance trying to phone it in. Nobody's going to go into a performance like trying to mess it up. But like in rehearsal, that's your time to be like, hey, this happened. Let's try to make it more this way.
Yeah, like, to really utilize the time.
Yeah, yeah. And like in a given cycle, we don't have, I mean, there's a lot of like honing of little things of like, here, we want this stroke to be sort of like, we want this sort of middle of note, or we want like the cutoff to be more precise or whatever. Like it ends up being smaller details than like something that's going to change the flow of the whole concert. It's a lot more about cohesion and like having the same game plan, like right. keeping everything unified so that it's not me and other people. It's like the bass section is one unit. Sure. And then the strings are one unit, you know?
Sure.
And just trying to find like, how can I blend into that? Like, how can it be more like what everyone else is doing? And for bass, a lot of that doesn't filter down. Like the violins aren't going to come over to you and be like, hey, this needs to be fixed. Like you have to be kind of self-starting, because the conductor doesn't want to spend all day being like, basses, we need to be this. Like, that's not the point of the symphony. Like
sure.
we kind of need to be self-starting in terms of like finding those little details and deciding like we're gonna make that happen and make it like just a little better coming out of the back.
Yeah. Now I know you studied, we talked about this last week. You got your doctorate with Jeff Bratatich.
I did not finish my doctorate. I did all the classwork and then I won a job and left. But I do not have it. I do not hold a doctorate.
Are you still pursuing it?
No, unfortunately, North Texas does this fun thing called continuing enrollment, which means that you have to pay every single semester if you ever want to finish your coursework.
So you'd have to be paying right now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're in a time where like I'm spending 30 weeks a year in a hotel room, not even in Little Rock, you know?
Right.
And then the rest of it, I'm in Arkansas. I'm like, I can't go back and, you know. It would have been nice to get the doctorate, but as much as anything, I was really fortunate to use my time at UNT to like be at a very, very affordable school. So I could pay basically out of pocket. There was a ton of work in the DFW area where I was able to immediately like jump in and get into a lot of regional orchestras. That wasn't going to be what I was doing long term, but I could keep my head above water, pay for school, make rent, and not have to like get that grunt, not have to get that coffee shop job, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So like that was huge. Getting that time with Mr. Bratatich was huge. Like really smart, thoughtful, authentic guy, and just a really, really clued in teacher who's, you know, he's been there and he's done that. And he has a lot of things that are like kind of very unique to him, which is nice because I had a lot of different teachers. I studied with Max Dimoff and I studied with Ed Barker and I studied with Don Palma. And it was like definitely three different flavors of ice cream. And then coming back in and getting a fourth one was huge. Like, it's so nice to be able to think back to like excerpt classes with five, six different teachers where you've looked at the same thing and everybody has different non-overlapping, conflicting opinions about pretty much all the experts, you know, and being able to sort of take all the stuff you learned and then like filter it through your own taste and like what you want to get out of it was really helpful. It was, I feel really fortunate to have had all those different perspectives is what I mean. Yeah.
We'll be back right after this.
The features are brought to you by the International Society of Bassists. Stop by isbworldoffice.com to check out the latest news in the double bass community. All right, folks, get heard on the Bass Shed podcast. I am opening up the middle of the show to talk about what you all are up to. Stop by thebassshed.com, click on Get Featured, and let me know what news you'd like me to share. If it's upcoming gigs, if it's your website, if it's your social media handles, if it is your YouTube page, whatever it is, stop by thebassshed.com, click on Get Featured, and exactly that, get featured on the Bass Shed podcast. Again, on Sunday, March 3rd, the Bass Shed Academy is proud to present a masterclass by Eric Curtis. Eric Curtis is a touring upright and electric bassist, songwriter, producer, arranger, and composer. Eric will discuss the importance and value of having a diverse skill set and how the sensibilities of a bass player translate into some of these other fields like songwriting and music production and composition. If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please support the show. Help us keep the lights on. That's really what it is. I got to keep the lights on in the studio. Right. What are we on? Episode 118? Huh? I'm not in this for the money. I genuinely love connecting with all these bass players. I just got to pay the bills. That's it. Please consider supporting the show. There are several ways to support the show. With warm hearts, right? That does matter, right? You can support it with a warm heart. Also a little bit of money. Not going to lie. There's, you know, the warm heart doesn't keep the light on. Not, you know. It's like when you play a gig and everybody's like, oh, we loved it. And they walk right past the tip jar. Like, oh, great. Yeah. I'm going to tell my landlord that 13 people loved it. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. I got like 5 good jobs, 13 we loved it, and two, when are you coming back here? Let's see if that keeps the lights on at the apartment. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. If you're enjoying the show, please consider supporting. You can support through Buzzsprout. You can support through Patreon. My hope is that people and folks decide to get featured on the podcast, not because it's like more money than the other two, but I really want this podcast to build and cultivate a community and share with listeners what other listeners are doing and where to find them and where to engage with them. Also, the community building thing is really important to me. So, rant over about the tip jar. Again, this has been brought to you by International Society of Bassists.
Excellent, sir.
Now, when you teach, let's say, said expert, where you had 5 different approaches to it, do you find yourself gravitating to one approach more than the others? Not all the time, but like, if it's, you know, excerpt A over here, like, okay, yeah, I like how this person talked about it. From all the other perspectives I got, I kind of agree with that one. Now on excerpt B, I kind of choose someone else's approach on that. Or have you assimilated all the approaches and you have your own kind of approach to it now that's influenced by all those?
I think more the second one. Like, it's really important, like you know how a camel is a horse that's built by committee?
Okay.
Like, it's really important not to try to be like everything to everyone. And sure. I don't think that's doable anyway. So like, it's really hard to be like, you can't take 5 different opinions and do them all at the same time. Like, you need to find, like, yeah. I think like, for example, Todd Siebert or Scott Dixon, like the way they explained this particular passage was like great. Like, those are the notes I'm taking. Like, thank you. You just dropped this pearl before me. And like, yeah, you know, yeah. If you're in classes long enough and you watch people you yourself make those mistakes. And then as you get older, you turn around and you watch younger students make those same mistakes and get different feedback. Like, you're just like, oh, I've seen this before. Like, I know what this is. And then I know what two or three other people might say about it. But then, like, you filter that through your own taste. You filter that through your own discernment. Mm-hmm. So it's like, take everything you've been from, but then don't try to make that camel. Like, try to make it something that's yours and that's influenced by everyone else, but not, you're not trying to recreate. I would if I could, but I don't want to play like Max Dimoff. I don't want to play like Scott Dixon. I very much do. But,
yeah. Right.
Like, I want to play like me.
Of course.
And yeah. But it's like an illusion. Like, you reference those other seminal texts, but then, like, I'm trying to speak too.
Yeah, for sure. I brought up Jeff Bratitich because I was curious. Do you do solo work? Like, I know he does a lot of solo work. Is that something you've gotten into?
I've played solos a lot. Going back all the way to high school, I played concertos with my high school orchestra, but, like, boy, it's tough out there for bass. Like, there's not a lot. No one's beating down your door to be like, hey, do you want to play the Von Hall concerto?
Right.
Like, we need a guy. Right. Like, yeah. You have that dinner store, Freddie? Like, it's not, the phone's not ringing that way. So, like,
yeah.
I was really fortunate that, like, I got to play a lot of great recitals when I was at North Texas and when I was at BU, when I was at CIM as well, and Yale as well. Like, playing the solo recitals or getting to play chamber music, like, that's been my biggest thing for that. But, like, yeah, for me, the phone's not ringing as much to come in and play solos with orchestra. Like, maybe once I get tenure with Arkansas, I can swing it and play something with them. But, like, yeah.
Yeah. But is that still,
I'm fortunate though. I've gotten to play a lot of chamber music. So, like, being one and a part is a lot like that too.
Sure. Is that something that, you're interested in or inspired by enough to really pursue? Or is it, because I know so much of this conversation has been very much about the working aspect of either principal or section player, but it's been a very, I don't want to say blue collar approach, but it's very much about working as a musician. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about that so far. Whereas, like, the soloist, like, yeah, that's work, but it's a different thing. Like, that's not the working world necessarily, as I see it. But I'm also not a classical player.
Sure.
So,
and I mean,
straighten me out if I'm out of line here.
I mean, I'm for sure not as plugged into that world of, like, having a talent agent and getting hired by orchestras and soloing like that as a lot of other players, for sure. But I do have friends that do that. I have a friend who's a very fine violin soloist named William Hagen. We've known each other a long time, but, man, he's just, it's kind of a similar thing. I feel where, like, he's got, I assume, I'm not entirely sure. Like, he's got his book of, like, all the stuff he could bring to your orchestra. So, like, his craftsmanship is, like, keeping that honed and keeping that diamond sort of strong. And then, like, the phone will ring or his agent will be like, here you go, you got to get on a plane. And, like, it seems like a higher stakes, better paid, more stressful version of that other stuff, you know.
Sure.
Like, it's hard for me to imagine soloists like Jeff or like these other people, your Hilary Hahn, your Anne-Sophie Mutzer, whoever. Like, it's hard for me to not see them and see that craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. Like, I think music and sports go together so well. And I like to think of, like, a lot of those Olympic sports, like when you see a gymnast and they do that floor run and you're like, oh my God, you see this grace, you see this motion. And then you're like, what I'm really watching is 100,000 hours of work.
Right.
And, like, there's something really beautiful about that. And you're not just watching, like, talent, you're watching drive and you're watching
dedication and, like,
proven. Yeah.
Right.
And so I think that, like, that's the thread that runs underneath performing, which is sports, which is everything else. It's like gaining and then maintaining and then applying your skills.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have one of those three, it's not going to function.
Right. Right.
So I wish I could do it more and have a better perspective on it, but like soloing seems to me just a higher stakes version of that. Like,
right.
I don't know that I've played a perfect concert ever. Like, I don't know that it's like, I don't know that I've gone and played every single note in a whole concert perfectly. I don't know that that's ever happened, but like soloists might be able to say that. And I think that's a different sort of ethos.
Now, what degree, what margin of error are we talking about here? Because, again, not a classical player, but, I mean, so are we talking about margin of error of, like, you're missing notes? Or, like, no, maybe I should have put a little different vibrato on the C sharp going into it? Like, are we talking about, like, microscopic nuance where you feel like you don't play it 100%, or you're just like, yeah, I just played a B flat instead of a B. What the hell?
Both. Yeah, like definitely both.
I love the candid answer. I love it. Yeah. Okay.
Like, I mean, it's a volume issue.
Yeah.
It's kind of like I was working with Dennis Whitaker, who is the principal in the Houston Grand Opera for, I think, forever, basically like 20 yeah. years. And he was like, you know, playing opera, it's like playing Frogger. It's like playing the video game Frogger on the easiest level for like 3 hours
yeah.
and never dying. Like that's like such a skill to just like stay locked in and like, or like, yeah, I'm sure you may have had this happen where you're like, you've got that page that you know, and you've got it. You did it with the metronome. You're hitting it.
Right.
You get to the end of the excerpt and it like, you play the downbeat and then it's like, 27 measures of rest with a big Q, and you're like, bam, you hit that final downbeat, and you're like, yeah, I got, oh, what measure are we in? Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
you know, like little stuff like that, where you're just like it's hard to maintain that mental like feeling of being locked in for so long, for sure. Like stuff is going to happen, or you know,
yeah. How do you address that, or practice that, or go within yourself to fine tune that and, you know, kind of work that muscle?
I think it's important to try to, yeah, yes. And I mean, doing it and also like having an institutional knowledge of the piece, like
sure.
you want, even if you haven't played something before, you should show up like you've been there before, you mm-hmm. know, like, and that means like doing your score study. Like if you see that spot, like you get the part and you look and you're like, oh, 35 measures of rest. Let me get my score and write in some cues and listen to it.
Right.
Like having that work done beforehand is like huge, because I'm 32. I'm in an orchestra with someone who's 52, who has played that symphony 20 times. And when I
right.
screw that up, they're going to look over at me and be like, hey kids, like, what are you doing?
Right.
You know? And so like institutional knowledge is huge, but also trying to realize that like it is a process, and trying to commit yourself to like not making the same mistake twice is huge. Like something's
right,
gonna go, something's gonna be in a different place or just be spongy where you didn't expect it, and you're gonna drop a pits right before the down, you know, that downbeat, and just be like but like you kind of like sometimes you get one but you don't get two, so mm. like you're like, oh, that happened. Like big circle, put the eyeglasses in, like look down the section and like make sure you'd be like, hey, that was my bad. Like we gotta lock in on that downbeat, and like or whatever the situation is, where it's like it happened once, it won't happen again. Like you get that one, and then that's it.
As a principal player, when you someone in the section is making reoccurring mistakes. Now we've already talked about where being a disciplinarian isn't that's something you look forward to within the job.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach it? Do you leave them to do the self-editing? Like, you know, you just messed up. You know, mm-hmm. let's see if it happens again. Huh, happened again. You know you messed up twice.
Mm-hmm.
Third time, is it three strikes, you're out? Is it, do you jump in and address it?
If one of the things about being a principal player is like when you're in the section, I'm matching my sound to the section and trying to push it forward. But like as principal, it's really hard to be like, here's my conception of what I should sound like. Here's the section, but then here's what's happening behind me. And like comparing that to my playing to the section, sometimes for me, it's too much. And so like sometimes my stand partner will be like, hey, did you hear that? And I'll be like, well, not this time, you know, like,
right.
So it's to the point where like in an orchestra in that environment, sometimes it is really hard to listen back and like, there's going to be stuff that I'm missing, but like, if something is happening, if I hear something multiple times, or if just like it's something that's nuts and bolts, like it's kind of everybody, or you get to that pause in rehearsal and you're like, hey, you know, guys, this wasn't quite right. Like this needs to be here. And it's never a point of like judgment. It's just like, this is the product we need to make. And, and like, let's get there.
Keep it in a team sport.
Does that answer your...
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a team sport. It's the ultimate team sport. Except for maybe football, I don't know. But like you get all these different people all coming together to make one organism. It is.
For sure.
And I'm lucky I have that team sport background.
You talked about, you know, being 32 and someone in the orchestra maybe 52. Have you found any kind of vibe from the older cats in the orchestra? Like, are they throwing you a little bit like, yo, what's up with this young kid principal guy? And like politically or generationally, is there any kind of thing you've encountered that way, or are they really good at hiding it?
I think age is one of those things that maybe may just be bad at picking up on it.
Like, I'm just a joke.
As someone who thinks everybody hates them anyway, like, yeah, totally. I would hope not. I think that there's something, I don't think I've had like too much of that, but I'm sure it's been thought, you know, but just everybody.
Are there people younger than you?
In
the orchestra?
Yeah. We've got a few that are younger than me.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I would say I'm probably in the bottom 20 percentile for age and like overall in the orchestra.
Sure. That makes like sense.
In the youngest. Yeah, for sure. But no, I think I've had a lot of good experiences with a lot of the older colleagues, especially in Arkansas Symphony. Like there's a few people right now I'm thinking of that are like, yeah, I would love to play something with you, or like played something in rehearsal and like the tuba player turns over and he's like, yeah, man, you know, something like
okay.
that. Like,
okay.
I think it's like age is a segregating thing. Like a lot of the 20 and 30 year olds, they're not going to go seek out those people who are older, but then you're going to have those moments where you're like, you're sitting next to each other on chamber music. You're like, hey, it's great to play with you. Like bringing that positive vibe to people and just being like, we're all here doing the same job. Like,
yeah,
it's just, you know,
what I've liked about this talk so far is there's like this, all this information that, even though, you know, probably the majority of people that listen to this are not principal bassists in a symphony, but my favorite part is like that we've covered a lot of information that it's applicable to so many, whatever they're playing, you know, just bass players and artists. Like it's a lot of just universal topics. On the topic that it could also be universal, how do you structure your practice time? Because I feel like that would kind of fall in line with where we're at, you know, like that's applicable to anybody practicing an instrument, specifically the bass. I don't think saxophone players are listening to this.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I definitely, when I made that switch, when I was at Mary Washington and then all the way through when I was at CIM and BU and Yale as well, I had been doing Max Dimoff's warm-ups, which is like, it takes between an hour and a half, 2 hours to do all the exercises cumulatively. And I was knocking those out 5 or 6 days a week, first thing in the morning. So like I would show up early, like just like if I had 9 o'clock classes, I was in the room at 7 and I would do that warm-up. And like, that was it. And like, that to me was just like getting my head above water. Like now you're floating and now you're ready to do that work. So like I would come in and I would knock out that warm up, go to class. And then by the time you're back from class, like you're ready to go a little bit again, you know, you get some calories and then like, that's your time to like take that manual work that you've been doing to build up that technique and now apply it, you know? Mm. As time has gone by, I found myself moving away from doing every single thing in there every day and taking it more into like sets of different exercises, incorporating stuff that I've stolen over the years from other people. And I try to get in and warm up and do only technique and only scales in as many different ways as possible for like at least an hour in the morning. Like, and if I don't get that time in, it's weird for me. Like, I feel right. Not okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, would so, you like, do
it all has to start from that foundation.
So daily, you're just investing in the foundation.
From there, yeah. Like, then it becomes practical.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there's a big bag of about 20, 25 things that I'll pick enough for like an hour and change, or however much time I have in that early morning session, and like try to knock that out. And then when you come back later, it's like you're walking, you know, it's like you can fly a little bit. You've already got your technique. You've already got your stuff.
Right.
Max used to tell me this story. Do you know the Carl Flesch scales system?
Yeah. The green book?
The big book. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that one.
He told me once someone at some festival, like Flesch was at the festival, and he was like, he brought him aside and he was like, oh, I just did the whole scale book this morning. And Flesch looked at him and he looked down at his watch and he's like, it's 4 p.m. You should have been done with that by 9:30. Like, why are you bragging? That's what the money's for. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. Like, that's what I think about. It's like, you don't want to be in the room. Like, you don't always want to be there, but like, neither do most people in a lot of the jobs that all the sure. time. Like, it's sure. not always fulfilling in that moment, but it's about that process, and it's about having that delayed gratification a little bit.
So you regularly do two practice sessions a day. The first one being in the morning, and it's the focus mm-hmm. is just on technique. And then what kind of do you just kind of structure it however it fits your day that day when session two will be? Or is it always a very systematic, like mm-hmm. session one, you know, take a walk, have something to eat for 45 minutes, and then I'm back in for another hour and a half? Like, is it?
It's definitely different now that I'm out of school. Like, because mm-hmm. in conservatory, you've got a lot of those obligations that are midday. And like, when you're freelancing, like if you're teaching, even if you're teaching a lot, like during the school day, unless you're going into school and teaching in school, you've got like the school day, the work day, right. basically free. So like, in addition to all the other nonsense you have to do to keep your life on track, like,
yeah.
You kind of look at your week and say like, all right, here and here today, like that's what I've got. And then keeping a journal has been huge.
Sure.
So like being able to be like, all right, I've got an hour and a half this afternoon. Like, what have I looked at this past week? And like, what have I not looked at? Like, what's mm-hmm. that thing that's sitting on the back of my stand that's like, oh, crap, I got to learn those notes.
Right.
You know, like, have you heard of that A-list, B-list, C-list sort of mentality?
No. When I was doing a journal, I still kind of play around with the journal thing, but I don't use it like that. I modeled my journal experience after the Orin O'Brien thing. And some of that I would go mm-hmm. through, like what she called them, like the vitamins or something. Like you know, you do two sessions and like it's kind of structured like this. And I took the structure of her practice model, but applied all mm-hmm. my own stuff to it.
I've only worked with her once. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What's her system like?
I haven't worked with her personally. I when I first got to LA, I took some lessons with a classical bass player who's now the assistant principal in Colorado. And he had studied with her at Juilliard. And she's got two sessions, and it's like, it's very... for the lack of a better term, microdosed. It's like 20 minutes on this, you know, like the first session will be like an hour and a half, 2 hours or something. And it's very much 15 minutes of this, 20 minutes of that, 15 minutes of this, you know, and you really don't start. And that mm-hmm. includes playing like pieces you're comfortable with for maintenance, you know? So it's not just maintaining technique, but it's maintaining repertoire. And then, you know, there's a portion in the second session where you're investigating either new etudes or new pieces or whatever. And I took that model and I was applying it a lot to the jazz thing, and where you'd play old repertoire or new repertoire, mm-hmm. I was just doing transcriptions or learning new tunes or whatever. Totally. But I liked her model a lot. And so that didn't really have an A-list, B-list, C-list thing. But it was very much, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, part of my practice space back in the day was like an egg timer. Like 15 minutes, scales. Whatever ones I don't get to, pick totally. Up there tomorrow. You know, and like, mm-hmm. whatever, I'm doing scales for 15 minutes. Whatever I don't get to, all right, tomorrow I pick up on D flat, you know, great.
Yep.
Instead of trying, because I had...
That seems quite similar.
Okay. Because I had, I mean, before that, like, I had, like, well, if I'm doing scales, it's 4 hours straight of just scales till I can't stomach it anymore. You know, burn myself out mm-hmm. on it, and then won't touch it again for another 2 weeks. That it was a very erratic approach to practicing for a while.
Totally. Something I took from doing those warm-ups the way that Max used to do them and have really gravitated towards was he wouldn't do scales. He would do scale. So he would do his whole warm-up in one key, more or less. The things that were tonal, he was staying in one key. And the way he did it was he was like 12 months, 12 keys. I'm staying in this key for the whole month. So like all of his scales in that warm-up session were in one key.
Now you're just picking like a tonic note. With that. Is this like everything in B flat major, or is like B flat? Now we're doing B flat minor, B flat major, the different minor forms, and everything's in relation to B flat, or is it specifically all a major tonality or a minor tonality that he's doing?
There were some that worked in sort of modes. So, the first exercise on that thing that he would do is called vomits. It's a Gary Carr thing. It's a Gary Carr exercise.
Okay.
So like imagine you start with just like first finger on the bottom of the scale, and then you're going up and it's a 2-octave scale, but you're going to the next note and then back to the root, and then the next note up and then back to the root.
Yeah,
so like da 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 da. And you run that 2 octaves up and down through all of the finger combinations. So like start on one, end on one, start on one, end on two, blah, 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 all the way through. And like,
he would
always do it on the G's. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The Bratatus shifting exercise. Right. It's all in that same like coaching tree. Exactly. Right. And so he would stay in one key, but because he was on the G string, he would do it in different modes. So like A flat major, you're perfect. You can start A flat Ionian, do 2 octaves of that, and then B flat Dorian, blah, blah, blah. But like if you're in C major, you're going to be like in A Aeolian. And if you want, you could go B Locrian, you could go C Ionian, like be right back in that thing. So like one tonality, but like different modes. A lot of it would be pegged into the major keys though.
Okay. I see. But he wouldn't do like, you know, a whole tone or something. Cause like, I know like some people would just pick a note, a pitch, and then base their whole scale system off of that. Like I'm going through major, but then like even, so if you're going to say for this conversation, C is the starting note. You're going to do C Ionian, C Dorian, C Phrygian, C Lydian, C Mixo. You know, go through it all that way. All the different forms of minor off of C. The diminished scales, the whole tone, everything, melodic minor, blah, blah. But everything's in relation to C instead of, you know, everything being related to a tonic, which is what you were talking about.
A little bit. I think... That's a very jazz-oriented way to look at that, where you're thinking about it creatively based on that one sort of starting point.
Sure.
There were definitely, like, we would do arpeggio patterns that would go, like if you're in C, it'd be like C, C minor, back to C, A, you know, A minor, F major, D, minor 7, and then good, like, G7 and C, like, make a standard sort of thing, and then, like, C diminished or whatever, But no, there wasn't as much of like of living in the other tonalities. I don't know. Okay. There was something about like having the one tonic note, but
yeah.
Not that that, I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way.
No. That's
not like a little bit, but not, no, we weren't like, yeah, no, there wasn't quite so much as like, oh, let's take it back in this way. It was more like,
I mean, like, just
like
for
a
me,
craftsmanship thing.
Just for me, like, talking about that shifting exercise, to go through it, and this is just how my brain works, to go through it, you know, either starting, if we're going to be in C major again, and you're going to start A, Aeolian, and then work through the shifting exercise, mm-hmm. B, Locrine, all the modes. I think if you just, it's all the same to me. So it's
yes.
One, the same sound, and it's the same thing. So you on an open string, if you take an open string and you, for this shifting exercise, you start with the lowest fingered pitch, which would yes. be A, you've already yes. played them all. If you play exactly. through A with through something. All the combinations, like you've already played everything else just by playing the one. So if you start at the lowest and you do all the combinations, you got it.
Yes, absolutely. That was something Max would say. He's like, yeah, I do shifting drill every day because like everything on bass is shifting.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a discrete number of shifts that you can be offered. So it's like,
right.
Oh, I've seen that before. And it's like right there.
Right.
Like it was less about the key you're living in than about like accuracy and the craftsmanship of like making sure that the way you shift is polished and smooth and relaxed,
sure.
and that the way you're allocating your bow is polished and smooth, and the that you're shifting, like you're it's. I get very philosophical about that exercise because it does so much. Like mm-hmm. that shifting drill exercise is like seminal. If you do that, you will get better at bass immediately.
Yeah, agreed.
It
works with so much. It works with like sound production and. Like how quick you engage with the string, you know, the release of it.
Mm-hmm.
It works with all these mm-hmm. little nuanced things that I don't know if there's a better way to address those things because you don't even know you're doing it until you finally realize that that's part of the exercise. And then when you start
yeah.
thinking about those little aspects, you're like, I don't know how else I would have practiced that. I don't know how else I would have gotten
yeah.
those things together.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. That's,
I mean, and that's like the aura exercise. Like it's everything comes out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. That's so, a, that's
that was,
a great
that
exercise.
Was so
yeah.
vital to like developing as a player. It's
just sure.
like, why does I'm shocked when I don't see other people doing it all the time. I'm like, do you know this? And they're like, yeah. And like, you know, or whatever. They're like, I do something else. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Like this right. works for me.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, Russell, thanks so much for being on the podcast, man, and have a great concert. What do you got coming up after your time in Amarillo? What do you got coming up?
So we got Bartok Concerto for Orchestra with Amarillo this week. Next week, I'm going back home to Arkansas Symphony. We're playing Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony,
okay,
and a Bach Flute Concerto with one of our flute players. Can't wait for that. It's gonna be great. After that, I go to Texarkana, I believe, and I'm playing Shostakovich 10, and then going up to Fayetteville, and I forget what we're playing there. Something
right.
like that, yeah.
Cool,
yeah, just it's just one after the other.
Yeah, yeah, you got it all dialed in.
And yeah. It's a lot. Well, hey, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been really great.
Yo, this is Craig Gash.
What up?
Subscribe to the podcast.
I am.
Follow us on the Instagram,
yeah.
the YouTube.
Okay.
Leave us a comment.
I just stubbed my toe.
All right. That was my talk with Russell Thompson, the principal bassist of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. I am honored that he has taken an interest in the Bass Shed Academy and that we are putting together a course right now about popular excerpts for the classical double bassist. I think that'll be a really, really good resource for the classical bassist and having a deeper understanding of some popular excerpts. You know, it's also like he sent me some of his ideas, and it's like just in the idea, I'm like, oh man, yeah, like I was already learning from it. So I'm really excited to be releasing it for maybe people that don't dig that much into classical but want to have a little bit more of that in their playing and in their technique. It'll be great for that. It'll be great for the young classical player, you know, maybe preparing things for auditions, stuff like that. It's just a great learning resource from the guy doing the job, right? He's the principal cat. He's the guy. He's the guy. It was a great time talking with him. That's about all I got for this one, folks. That's all I got. I'll catch you on the next one in a minute.